Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Climate change comes down to the rich versus the poor? Did you pay your dues? Bishop Desmond Tutu makes the argument in Copenhagen that since the First World helped pollute the Third World, shouldn't they pay to clean it up?
For those who think that the rich are going to escape.
Maybe I'll be there to shake your hand. Maybe I'll be there to share the land.
Maybe the U.S., Britain, and others will clean up the land in Africa, South America, and Asia. And maybe they'll shake hands over a deal this week. But maybe not. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Monday, December 14th. I'm Celeste Headlee with John Hockenberry. And The Takeaway for me, John, is whether the issue of climate change is actually going to widen the gap between the rich and the poor.
Oh, the real headline there from Bishop Tutu, the rich will not escape. There's your takeaway. Let's get right to it, though. This morning, Citigroup has reached a deal to repay the government $20 billion in bailout money. It's a complicated stock deal that allows Citi to become the last of the real big Wall Street banks to pay back what it owes.
And with most of the big banks now out of the bailout program, President Obama may lose some of his leverage when he meets with bank CEOs today at the White House. The president's expected to press them to provide more loans to small businesses. And if last night's interview on 60 Minutes is any indication, he'll appeal to their sense of civic duty.
The people on Wall Street still don't get it. They don't get it. They're still puzzled. Why is it that people are mad at the banks?
But is he going to lecture Jamie Dimon this morning at the White House? Call him a fat cat? I want to be a fly on the wall there. Making its way to the White House also today, a new $1 trillion spending bill. It passed the Senate yesterday. Includes more than 5,000 so-called earmarks. Things are heating up this morning at the climate talks in Copenhagen. Representatives from developing countries are blocking negotiations, we're learning, by refusing to participate in any of the working groups. They're demanding that rich nations raise their pledges for reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
For more details on that, we have Tom Berkowitz with us. He joins us from Copenhagen. Burke is the founding director of E3G, an environmental policy advisor. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
We've been hearing a lot about this disagreement between first and third world countries. So tell me, what is the divide here? What's the difference between what the third world wants and what the first world is willing to give?
Well, I think there are two things. One is money to pay for adaptation to changing climate and mitigation. And the other thing is they want the developed world to do more to reduce its emissions so that the climate doesn't get worse.
So which one of these, is it money or is it blame that's going to be the deal breaker possibly for this deal happening on Friday?
Could be both, but I think money is the key to the door. If we can solve the money problem, then it gets a bit easier to solve some of the other problems.
Okay, stay with us, Tom Burke. We'll be back with you in just a moment, but first, more headlines.
The U.S. military says it warned Iraqi officials about possible attacks in Baghdad the same day as coordinated bombings killed 127 people there last week. The military did say there were no specific actionable intelligence warnings in its data that it warned the Iraqis about. Across the border in Iran, Iran intends to put three Americans on trial for espionage charges. U.S. officials say they mistakenly crossed a poorly marked border while hiking in northern Iraq. Dubai received a $10 billion bailout this morning from oil-rich Abu Dhabi. The last-minute cash infusion is aimed at preventing an outright debt default by Dubai's largest company, Dubai World.
And the first major sponsor has ended its relationship with Tiger Woods. The global consulting firm Accenture says he's no longer the right representative for the company. European indices are up in afternoon trading. Asian markets, though, are mixed. Wall Street futures up on the news coming out of Dubai and Citigroup, and the Dow will open at 10,471. The S&P gets underway at 1106, and the NASDAQ will start at 2190.
Coming up, family life every Monday. How do you deal with stressful economic details in your life when there's kids around? We're going to talk about that later this hour. And we're also looking at your life in fine print. After the financial collapse, we've all had to be more vigilant about the fine print, the fees in our lives. Even to know how much energy we're using involves knowing the fine print. Tell us a story of how you've paid more attention to fine print in your life, and maybe you've been fleeced by fine print. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Today we begin the second week of the International Climate Change Summit in Copenhagen. And what the countries that are there are discovering is that when you bring 192 countries together to try and reach some kind of agreement, all of them have different priorities, and that's stalling the agreement talks. We've learned just this morning that representatives from developing countries are refusing to participate in any working groups. They're demanding that rich countries raise their pledges for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. We're joined now by Tom Burke. He's the founding director of E3G, and he's an environmental policy advisor. Also with us, Bjorn Lomborg joins us, director of the Copenhagen Consensus Center. That's a think tank. He's also author of the book The Skeptical Environmentalist. He joins us from Copenhagen. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Tom, let's talk a little bit about this deal that they're talking about for Friday. When we went into the Copenhagen Climate Summit, everyone was saying that we were probably not going to reach any kind of deal and we probably wouldn't see anything actually in paper until next year. So what is the deal that we're talking about for Friday?
Well, I think that people have been talking about it happening in two parts, really. A political bargain that will be made in Copenhagen and finished this week, which will set the frame for a treaty that people need to do next year. And hopefully, I think a lot of people are arguing now, has to be done by about June next year.
So this is the political piece of what is essentially an update to the Kyoto Protocol?
No, it's much more than an update to the Kyoto Protocol. It really is a sort of broader treaty that will involve more people and a wider range of issues to be dealt with. So there's an argument about whether to continue with the Kyoto Protocol or not, but what's really under discussion is a much bigger bargain involving, for instance, forests, a lot of other things that weren't dealt with in the Kyoto Protocol.
Bjorn, you're well known for acknowledging that global warming exists, but saying it's perhaps not the top priority in the world, correct?
That's pretty much correct, yes.
So do you think we need to make this agreement, the one that Tom is talking about?
Well, I think, first of all, Tom is absolutely right in his analysis that this is what most people expect will come out. The problem that I have with this deal is essentially it's following the same failed strategy of the last 18 years. It's essentially a lot of promises which we've done for 18 years. We promised a lot of cuts in Rio in 1992, and we didn't do them. Then we promised even grander cuts in Kyoto in 1997, and we still didn't do them. And so coming together in Copenhagen and simply making even grander promises are not actually going to do anything for climate. It's just simply spinning the wheels on the road to nowhere.
All right,
so
Bjorn,
I would suggest we should do something that's smarter.
All right, well, let's talk about that for just a moment. I mean, is that a failure of the promises and the rhetoric of the nations themselves, or is it a recognition that we actually don't have the mechanisms to enforce any promise, grandiose or otherwise?
It's not been the failure Bjorn says it's been. There have been significant reductions around the world from what would have otherwise happened, and they've happened precisely because there was an international agreement in place. So it's a bit cavalier to dismiss all of that out of hand and all the things that lots of people and lots of countries have done to reduce emissions.
That's Tom Burke of of E3G. Bjorn?
Yes, and let's just be honest. I mean, here I do disagree with Tom, and unfortunately for Tom, the data is on my side. Fundamentally, if you look at what's actually come out of the Kyoto Protocol, we promised to cut emissions, which would have been the equivalent of cutting 11% of global emissions by 2010. Instead, we'll probably end up cutting about half a percentage point. So we did about 1/20. So I would submit that we've done virtually nothing. And John, to answer your question, fundamentally the reason is that we do not have the technologies to make this cheaply. We can do it very, very expensively, but of course very few nations are going to do that. A few well-meaning Westerners might do it, but we're not going to get most of the world on board for doing a dramatic carbon cut. That's why we should be investing a lot more in research and development into green energy technology, because before it's cheap, we won't get most people to do it.
Okay, Bjorn Lomborg is, of course, the author of The Skeptical Environmentalist, which is what we're hearing from him right now. Tom Burke, do you have a response to him talking about all of our solutions being too expensive?
Picking up the data he likes and saying it shows things, and there's lots of other data that shows different things. The most important piece about saying it would cost too much, the McKinsey's have done an enormous amount of work showing that you get about half of what you need to get at no cost at all, simply by doing the things we haven't been doing to improve energy efficiency. So it would not only be good for the environment, it would also be good for the economy. And actually, because those things that you do are very widely dispersed around the nation, they would create an enormous amount of jobs in the way. Now, that's McKinsey speaking. I'm inclined to think they probably know what they're talking about on this subject.
Tom, are the discussions getting stalled over who to blame? I mean, as you were talking earlier about the divide between first and third world countries, are the third world countries partially trying to say that the first world was responsible for global warming and therefore is responsible for the bulk of the cleanup?
I don't think it's that issue that's stalling the things. I think the issues are really substantive issues that are stalling it. How much money is going to be on the table? What level of reductions are going to be on the table? But certainly there is, people are beginning to maneuver for a blame game. And what's happening from the African countries, and particularly in the small island states, is they're saying, look, what's at stake here is survival. This isn't, for us, a sort of issue about does it cost a little bit more or do we lose a few jobs. For them, it's a real question about whether they can maintain prosperity and security and the stability of the state at all. So they are not so much in a blame game as trying to say, listen, pay attention to us.
So Bjørn Lomborg of the Copenhagen Consensus Center, you heard what Tom just said. Although you feel as this is, perhaps is not the best thing that the world could be working on right now, he says that for the third world countries and developing countries, it's crucial.
Yes, and that is definitely what a lot of developing countries are saying. Clearly, they are seeing this as a gigantic honeypot that they can actually get hundreds of billions of dollars. The negotiator for the African countries actually suggests that we should be paying $2,500 billion a year to the developing world. Of course, that's not going to happen. And the underlying problem, of course, is this really where they need the most money, or is that indeed to deal with the many other problems like malaria, malnutrition, lack of clean drinking water, all the other issues? But let me just point back to say that Tom is also telling us that McKinsey is saying that we could do all of this for cheap or maybe even for free, half of it for free. But, of course, the real point that most economists would make and not a consultancy agency is to say, well, that's why it hasn't happened, because it actually is expensive. And we know most countries realize this is going to be phenomenally expensive. It's not going to be the end of the economy, of course not, but it is a huge outlay.
Okay,
that's why we're not seeing this happening.
That's Bjørn Lomborg. He's director of the think tank, the Copenhagen Consensus Center. For the last thing, Tom, I want you to listen to this cut again from Bishop Desmond Tutu.
For those who think that the rich are going to escape.
He seems bemused by that idea. What does Bishop Desmond Tutu know that the rest of us do not?
I think he's completely misunderstood it. The problem is we won't escape. You know, our economies in a globalized world don't succeed if other economies fail. And if the kind of things that are going to happen with climate change in China, in India, in South America take place, then that will really kick back on us. So I unfortunately agree with Desmond Tutu on that.
Okay.
When it comes to knowing what's good for you, know, I'm inclined to believe that the leaders of the African countries know better than Bjørn Lomborg what's in the interest of their people. And they're all in Copenhagen right now saying we want some action on this, and this is what matters to us.
Tom Burke is the founding director of E3G. It's 15 minutes past the hour. Let's take a look at the headlines.
Citigroup has reached a deal to pay back the Treasury $20 billion of bailout money. The announcement comes just as the president is about to meet with top financiers at the White House today. The Treasury says it's actually made a profit on the Citibank deal. Overseas, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen is in Afghanistan for a series of meetings with government officials. In Iran, three American hikers are going on trial for espionage, according to Iranian officials. Relatives and the State Department say the hikers accidentally crossed that border between Iraq and Iran. In auto news, Toyota has unveiled its latest Prius hybrid. It's a plug-in car that gets about 135 miles to the gallon. The car is expected to go on sale in 2011, but is available for lease beginning this month in the United States. Coming up, we're living in a post-Tiger world. Tiger Woods, that is. What does it mean for golf with Tiger Woods taking a break and some of his sponsors taking a break from him? We'll find out in just a few minutes.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news takeout comes from my demented imagination. What if the PGA announced, okay, over the weekend, that from now on, golf balls will not be white and hard, they'll be made out of styrofoam? That's it. Period.
Wow, the they'd end. Really fly.
That would be huge. It didn't happen, of course, but what did happen over the weekend is probably at least as big. Tiger Woods, announcing he's on hiatus given all the scandal that's gone on in his life. He lost a big endorsement. Accenture says it no longer wants to have a relationship with Tiger Woods. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. This is a big story. Can you imagine golf without Tiger Woods in this day and age?
I don't think you can imagine golf without Tiger Woods, especially what he means to golf. I mean, at this point in time, he's expanded the reach of golf. He's equalized the playing field in a sense. He's made it more attractive to people of different backgrounds and non-traditional golf viewers now see themselves in the game of golf. So they've been attracted to the game.
So there's a diversity piece.
Correct.
But there's also just a huge raw numbers piece. I mean, the television ratings for golf tournaments went through the roof after he won that Masters, which really blazed him onto the stage. And also the actual purses of tournaments. I mean, every golfer has benefited.
He was a great person for golf in that he was a great role model for young people and also for the image of golf as being this like place this sport of integrity and a sport of like of competitiveness. And Tiger Woods embodied that energy and he brought that to the viewers.
But, you know, here's an email from Stuart who says, please no more talk about Tiger. The man has asked for his privacy. His family should be afforded privacy during this time. The last thing they need right now is everybody picking apart every aspect of this man's failure to his wife and family. Golf will live on without him. I mean, this is the first moment in this entire conversation we've talked about his infidelity.
So who is that? That's
one of our listeners.
So, okay, so for that listener, golf, the PGA could now focus on their other stars that are under 30, like Hunter Mahan, Anthony Kim, Camilo Villegas, and Sean O'Hare, guys who came into the golf game because of Tiger Woods. He opened the door, and now they walk through, and that could be the new face of golf.
Could be, but didn't happen when Michael Jordan retired from the NBA, that's for sure. But it's an interesting idea. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, life after Tiger Woods, the PGA's dilemma this morning.
And now we're going to go to finance with Louise Story, a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise. Recently, mortgage rates have hit historic lows. We haven't seen them this low since the 1940s, but people aren't refinancing. They're not making new loans. This is an odd thing, Louise.
It's very odd. And in fact, interest rates are this low because of a massive Fed program where the Federal Reserve has been pushing them down. Back in the 40s, they did this to help finance World War II. They pushed interest rates down. This time, they did it to help the mortgage market recover. They've been buying up hundreds of billions of dollars of mortgage-backed securities in the market, which push rates down. The thing that's weird is that people are not refinancing their house. So, for instance, in 2003, when rates were falling, $2.8 trillion of mortgages were refinanced. This whole year, when rates have fallen to lowest since the 1940s, we've only had $1 trillion of mortgages refinanced.
So people are not applying to refinance their loans.
So there's two things. First of all, not as many people as you would expect are applying. You know, that 60% of homeowners with mortgages out there have rates that are above 4.8%. That's what you could get today if you go refinance your house. And 60% of people have above that. So first of all, not as many are applying. I think part of that is this, you know, people are not always rational about their homes. They're emotional. And I don't think they want to necessarily get it reappraised.
Well,
so
maybe it's because their credit ratings have fallen since the recession began.
That's the other part. So even the ones who are applying are facing a much harder time. You know, some people are saying it's like going in to get a root canal to get refinanced now. It used to be like going to Vegas, you know, but the banks are being really, really tough. Homes are underwater. They don't want to give loans for these high, lofty values that aren't true anymore. And so it's this conundrum. Rates are low, but they can't get refinanced.
Okay, Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
Our last takeout is something you guys stirred up while I was home with the baby on Friday. I don't know what you did, but a couple of conversations. We talked on Friday with some businesses that are going green. There was a local restaurant in Brooklyn, a green restaurant. But also the other business was not so local. Walmart drew this response.
Hi, my name is Bill. I'm calling from Detroit, Michigan. How come it seems like every time you have somebody on the air from a corporate world, such as Walmart's, it sounds like a commercial for how well they're saving the environment when everybody, and I mean everybody, knows it's just the opposite.
So what can they do that'll be less of a PR move for them but still helpful for you? Here's one piece of advice.
I wish that Walmart and lots of other stores like Target and Home Depot and all that would put more Energy Star information, especially big screen TVs. I think more consumers would start to factor that into their decision about which ones to buy.
And, of course, there's also the notion of eating green.
My name is Greg. I'm an urban farmer from Detroit. And just want to say that the local urban farming movement is starting to fuse with a lot of local restaurants. We're composting the vegetable waste. We're supplying local restaurants with a larger share more than ever of locally grown produce.
And John, before we go, we talked last week when you were out about the new movie Invictus. It has stars Morgan Freeman as Nelson Mandela. But you know what's missing from this movie about South Africa? South Africans.
We got
an email from Justin. He says, this story reminds me of Memoirs of a Geisha, where the entire leading cast was Chinese.
And it should have been Japanese, I guess, right?
That's the idea, suburbanite. But I was still insulted by Hollywood's idea that, oh, just pick some Asians and we're gold. The world is really a really big place. I would have liked to see some interesting South African actors in leading roles. Besides, Charlize Theron is one of our best South African actors today. Why not her in a role?
And she's in The Road. She's actually in a movie that's out, but she should have made it into Invictus, which is getting hugely fantastic reviews.
Great reviews.
Did you guys give it a good review last week?
We did.
You did. All right. Well, it sounds like an interesting story. Maybe I should have podcast The Takeaway last Friday. You can do that. Get anything you missed in the way of our podcast by going to 8778MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. We want your voices and your participation on anything we talk about. And we inaugurate our series today, Life in Fine Print, all this week. How to become more vigilant about the fine print details in our lives that really bear directly on all kinds of things, from finances to how much energy we use. Tell us your story. How have you been fleeced by the fine print, or what have you learned to pay more attention to? 8778MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the agenda.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, it's Monday. That means the agenda. We'll check that for you in just a few moments. But right now, let's check in on top news stories and the markets at about 30 minutes after the hour. Meltdown this morning at the climate talks in Copenhagen. Representatives from developing countries are blocking negotiations by refusing to participate in any working groups. They're demanding that rich countries raise their pledges for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Citigroup is the last of the big Wall Street banks to pay back its bailout money. Citi will return the $20 billion through a combination of stock and debt offerings.
It can be tough paying back those student loans. The Department of Education says 1 in 5 people who take out federal student loans to attend private colleges default on the loan within 3 years of starting to pay it back. And tonight is the best night of the year to see the Geminid meteor shower. Did I just say that right? Because it's a nearly moonless week. Astronomers say we should get a good view of the meteors as they create long arcs across the sky, many of them lasting a second or two. Best time to view them between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So word in the past half hour, ExxonMobil has agreed to buy natural gas producer XTO Energy for $41 billion in stock and debt. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow's going to open at 10,471. The S&P opens at 1,106. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Accelerating job growth.
Healthcare costs.
Iraq and Afghanistan.
Uranium enrichment.
Taxpayer costs.
Ask ourselves the hard questions.
What's the agenda this Monday morning? We spoke earlier with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, and Jonathan Marcus, diplomatic correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And we started by asking Todd to respond to this clip from Independent Senator Joseph Lieberman.
The so-called Medicare buy-in, the opposition to it has been growing as the week has gone on. And though I don't know exactly what's in it, from what I hear, I certainly would have a hard time voting for it because it has some of the same infirmities that the public option did. It will add taxpayer costs. It will add to the deficit. It's unnecessary.
Lieberman seems to be sounding like he doesn't want to vote for the deal that's now on the Senate floor. Todd, is the rest of the week going to be spent trying to coax him back into the tent?
Yeah, the so-called deal. I mean, John, the whole point of this so-called deal in the first place was because Joe Lieberman said a long time ago that public option means no vote from Joe Lieberman. So the question was, could this Medicare buy-in plus the other parts of this deal they were working on bring Lieberman on board? And he was making pretty strong signals on the Sunday shows yesterday that the answer is no. Now, if Lieberman doesn't know exactly what's in it, trust me, a lot of the rest of the senators don't know exactly what's in it. And there's a lot of discussions going on right now in private, back and forth between the Senate leadership and the Congressional Budget Office over how much this costs and how many people it covers. it's certainly not the death knell of the health care bill if Lieberman and a couple of the other conservative Democrats like Ben Nelson say no to this deal. What it does mean is that it's back to the drawing board for Harry Reid and the Democratic leadership yet again. They're not going to let this bill die. What they're going to have to do, though, is keep, you know, weakening the public option, possibly to the point where it's not politically palatable for the left anymore. They all want the strong public option. And the more that Lieberman and Nelson and maybe Claire McCaskill push on this, the you know, from the perspective of Obama's base, the weaker it gets.
Well, the whole agenda on healthcare is going to be about these individual characters who are going to try to force compromises, because it's all about 60 votes, and each individual senator who is balking at this is going to result in their own individual deal. Let's talk about the Congressional Budget Office, which seems to be enshrining itself as a kind of a overall congressional oversight committee. The CBO is going to look at this current health care bill and give some numbers. And Claire McCaskill, who you just referred to over the weekend, says that the CBO's verdict is going to be crucial for her.
Well, the whole reason we're doing this bill is to bring down costs, first for the American people in health care, and secondly for the deficit. So until we get the numbers back from the Congressional Budget Office, we're all on hold until I have to be assured that this is going to bring down the deficit and it's going to bring down health care costs for most Missouri families.
So the CBO, suddenly the new power on Capitol Hill.
It's like a star turn for the Congressional Budget Office, right? It seems like every couple of weeks we come back to that acronym, CBO. I mean, they've always been important with it inside the Beltway. They haven't been this important outside the Beltway. Geez, I don't know in how long. But McCaskill is feeling like a lot of other senators are feeling. They got to see these scores, and they have to see how many people it covers. And it's not just coverage for Americans. It's also coverage for senators. It's political cover on the deficit and on what this bill actually does. You know, they've got some breathing room on this deficit question, because remember the original health care bill, the Harry Reid sort of merged bill that we talked about so many weeks ago, had, you know, about a $90 or $100 million cushion of deficit. So he can spend a little bit more on this Medicare buy-in and still get there, but we're all just desperately waiting for these numbers.
And we should note that all of these cost numbers are abstract at this point. You know, this bill isn't even going to go into effect till 2016 at the absolute earliest. Jonathan Marcus over in London. A week ago, we were talking about serious demonstrations inside Iran. Today and all this week, we're going to be talking about pushback from the U.S. and Western nations on Iran's nuclear program. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is a very interesting front-page story in the Times newspaper of London. The Times has obtained a document, an Iranian technical document, which it says is a document talking about a uranium deuteride neutron source. This is a key element, potentially, of a nuclear weapon. So the article is essentially saying, crying foul, saying that the Iranians have been found out. The Iranians are indeed, or were certainly up until 2007, working on components of a nuclear weapon. And of course, the Times is expecting that this is going to have a huge impact on the developing debate now about stronger sanctions against Tehran.
Let's go down the science a little bit. The deuterium is so-called heavy water, and that's a neutron source which you would only need if you were making a nuclear weapon, right?
This is something called uranium deuteride. UD3 is the chemical formula. And this is essentially something that gives you the source of neutrons that lead to the extraordinary chain reaction that gives you this amazing and fantastic power from a nuclear explosion. Experts and analysts that the Times have spoken to, I've spoken to experts today as well, they say that this particular sort of material has no role in a civil nuclear program. And indeed, it's thought that Pakistan and China, indeed, have also looked at this material for a very similar role, potentially, in their own nuclear weapons.
Jonathan Marcus, where does this go next? To the IAEA, the United Nations Atomic Agency, or does it go to Washington, to the White House?
Well, look, I think, first of all, one has to say the BBC has not been able to independently verify the bona fides of this document. Let's for a moment assume that the Times is right and the document is what they say it is. Clearly, there are going to be a number of organizations that will want to see this evidence, and I'm sure the IAEA would be one of them. Depending on where the document actually came from, if it came from Western intelligence sources, presumably then Western governments would know about this already. But I think clearly it's going to be something that is going to be waved in front of the Russians and the Chinese. And people will be saying, look, you know, we need tougher sanctions now. If Iran's nuclear program is going to be stopped by diplomatic means. And I think if this piece of evidence is true, and if it's what the Times says it is, then it's going to be much harder for Moscow and Beijing to give Tehran the benefit of the doubt.
So over in Italy, first it was his business dealings, then it was his allegations of dealing with starlets. Now Silvio Berlusconi, the prime minister of Italy, attacked by a man who slammed a statuette into his face, breaking his nose and two teeth. Another bizarre episode for Silvio Berlusconi.
Well, it is indeed. I mean, he's an extraordinary political showman, isn't he? Not least the way he stood up after the attack and showed himself to the audience, tried to present himself as being okay. It is a remarkable sort of soap opera story, that of the highest echelons of government in Italy, and it's one we all follow here, I have to say, with a certain amount of amusement as well.
Jonathan Marcus, BBC diplomatic correspondent from Bush House in London. Todd, will Barack Obama get the bankers to reduce their salaries, yes or no?
He's told people he's the only thing standing between them and the pitchforks. So we'll see if he turns
at the White House today. There's your agenda. Thanks so much. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. We've been talking all this morning about the climate conference in Copenhagen and the divide between the first world and the third world. A lot of that is going to come down to carbon emissions and caps on carbon emissions. And in places like India, that's a sore point. So far, Indian response to European and American calls to carbon cuts could possibly be summarized as, if you want us to cap carbon emissions, you pay for it.
Do you think people are unfairly blaming India?
Yeah, we believe that.
Maybe.
We cannot blame India for all the emissions possible, as global warming is done by all global people.
That's the BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar talking with students in Delhi. He joined us earlier from Delhi, and we asked him about how educated those kids seemed to be when it came to carbon emissions.
Yeah, it was amazing, actually, just to get a sense of how much they knew about climate change and what it means for them and what it means internationally.
Here's another cut from a female student that you spoke with at a school there.
In USA, they use more electricity. They always use vehicles to travel small distances. We use public properties like buses and all, but they don't use all this.
This sounds like a little bit of anti-Americanism over the Americans' greediness on the global climate stage.
Yes, I think a lot of it is down to perception. There's a feeling here in India that it's getting pushed against the wall, that it's being held up, along with China, if you like, as the bad boys on the block, the people who are holding up any deal on climate change that can be achieved at Copenhagen. And if you like, what you heard there at that sort of very young level of students is some of that talk filtering down, where there's a sense that India is being penalised for something that they didn't create in the first place. And in general, a lot of people you speak to here in India, ordinary students, ordinary people, will just tell you, well, look at our lifestyles. I mean, they're nothing like the lifestyles of the West. How on earth are we supposed to be cutting back on our lifestyles and our consumption of energy to try and save the world when, you know, around us, clearly people lead these amazing lifestyles and they're not doing much about it?
Well, the numbers
that's the perception.
The numbers are on their side. I mean, per capita, Indians contribute 1.8 tons of greenhouse gases a year, and that's compared with the average American contributes 19 tons. So will the Indians wait for the Americans to come through with real pledges to cut carbon emissions before they will join suit?
Well, the Indian team, which is at Copenhagen at the moment, is a bit divided on this issue, because there's some, including very senior members of that team, who believe that India has very little choice but to be flexible, because around the world we are seeing now a sense that at least people are veering to the idea that they've got to do something. We've had China, for instance, come out with a statement of what they're planning to do, cutting down not on carbon emissions, but actually cutting down on putting some caps on their production. And so the sense is that India's got to agree to something, but as a sort of strategy in terms of negotiation, they'll hold out to the very last minute to see what's on offer, particularly from Washington and the European Union and other major economies, before signing up to something.
Sanjoy Majumdar is the BBC correspondent in Delhi. He joined us earlier this morning.
Those young people in India are so much more hip to the whole climate change
really
debate.
Really articulate.
Scientifically, yeah.
I understood every word they said, and it was all comprehensible.
Well, I love there's more English speakers in India than the entire population of the United States.
Wow, I wonder what that statistic really means.
India, huge.
Good morning, I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we talk about family life on Mondays, and we're going to talk today about how you deal with stresses within a marriage. The stress of marriage itself, the stress of having children in your marriage, and the stress of being tight on money as well. We'll talk about that in a few moments. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. Earlier this morning, Citigroup announced a deal to repay $20 billion in U.S. bailout funds. Our partner, The New York Times, reported earlier that the money will be raised by selling off stock. Joining us to give us the details is Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times, and of course, our takeaway finance contributor. What are the details here, Louise?
So Citigroup, you know, they've been negotiating for days. They desperately want to get out from under the government's thumb.
They're the last ones, right?
They're the last big bank that had exceptional existence. But there are some others. Wells Fargo and PNC, for instance, are some other large ones. They're also negotiating right now to get out. Everyone wants out, away from the scarlet letter taint of the bailout.
Right.
But they will be raising $17 billion in new common stock and another $3.5 billion of kind of a hybrid stock vehicle that'll count towards their capital ratios. So this will be dilutive to shareholders, the $17
billion. Right.
But then again, they'll get out from under TARP. TARP actually is expensive. The bailout's expensive. They've been paying billions of dollars of dividends to the government. So they'll get rid of that expense, but there'll be a lot more stock.
Is this deal as you expected?
It is. The other piece of it, which we'll have to wait to see how it plays out, is that, you know, Citigroup is the only bank that the government converted some of the preferred shares into common stock. So actually, we, the taxpayers, own 34% of Citigroup. And so the government's going to have to go to the market and sell that, which is an added step that doesn't exist with the other banks.
Last quick question. Does President Obama, as these banks leave the TARP, does President Obama lose his leverage to talk to the banks about lending and about salaries?
Well, you know, he's meeting with about a dozen banking chiefs today. He plans to ask them to do more lending and not to pay themselves too much money. It's kind of the same message he's been giving all year since he came in. But the reality is he does have less leverage now than he did last January because they're all getting out from this program. And so he may mostly be able to shame them now versus actually making them do things.
Well, we'll see if that works. Louise Story is a finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times.
In other news, we're following. The search goes on for two missing climbers on Mount Hood in Oregon. The climbers were reported missing on Friday, hours after they failed to return. The body of their partner was recovered over the weekend. Talks at the Global Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen have stalled. Developing nations have blocked negotiations and are demanding that richer countries pledge more money to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And in space news, NASA is hours away from blasting a new telescope into space. The telescope, known as WISE, will scan the cosmos for asteroids and comets that might threaten Earth. I feel better already. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Pull out of the shadows and find that eventually. There we are, where we are, and what we are is still family.
It is Monday, and we're here to talk about family on The Takeaway, and we're going to talk about stress. There's certain things that put a stress on a marriage. One of them, John, not surprisingly, is children. A marriage is more difficult. A marriage is difficult in and of itself, but then it becomes more difficult when you add kids, and it's even more difficult when you add tight finances into the mix. This may not be news to anybody, but there are some issues. There's some solutions here, and there's some news here that may be surprising. We're joined now by Susan Nolan-Hooksema. She's the psychology professor at Yale University and married mother of a 16-year-old boy, so she knows wherever she speaks. And Lamar Tyler is the married father of four young kids and co-author of the website blackandmarriedwithkids.com. He joins us from Maryland. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Lamar, first, let's go to you. Let's get your data here, your census data. Has it gotten harder for you to be a father and spouse during recent years?
I would say definitely with the economy and the effects of, just everything going on. Because my wife, her position, her company has laid off multiple positions. And my company, we've downsized some. And even though we haven't been directly affected by layoffs, it's something we're still seeing a lot on our blog. A lot of readers are saying that, one spouse may have been laid off, even both in situations. So you take that into account, you still have children. Something people don't think about a lot of times is the cost of child care. You know, you still have those kids, and they got to be in daycare. And if you have multiple children in child care, sometimes that can equal the same amount as a mortgage almost. You know, so, I mean, people have to take that into effect. And at the same time, you just can't drop kids out of child care because in a lot of cities like where I'm at, I'm in the D.C. area, it's hard even to get your kids in. You can't really get them in until spots open up, you know, at the beginning of the school year. So you can't really kind of flop them in and out and go that route. So I definitely say it's been hard the last few months. Or last few years, actually, since we've been in a recession.
Susan, there's been lots of research over the years talking about how much more difficult it becomes when you add kids into the mix of a family. And there's certainly lots of studies saying that money is a difficult issue for spouses. What's new here?
Well, I think it just confirms that the research that's been done over the last 20 years, that even with all of the modern conveniences we have and daycares and such, adding kids to the marital mix is tough, especially for women. Marital satisfaction goes down when kids enter the family, and it goes up when they go off to college.
But, I mean, at the risk of... I mean, I don't want to be disrespectful, but I mean, families typically don't acquire kids as a kind of like, you know, change the wallpaper sort of thing. I mean, it's a sort of central kind of goal of a lot of families. And
yeah.
I guess, you know, how do you evaluate this kind of information? I mean, you know, people are getting up this morning, having breakfast. I mean, what are the tools to actually deal with this stress? Because I don't spend much of my time thinking about, gosh, wouldn't it be great if my kids weren't here?
Absolutely. And I think the key thing is to remember to savor the good parts. I mean, we do have kids because we love them and we want to be part of their lives and raise these wonderful little creatures. And so I think we have to savor the good parts. And in terms of marital satisfaction, what we've got to do, I think this research just reminds us that we've got to pay attention to our marriage as well as our kids. It can be very, very time-consuming to take care of kids, and we can let our marriages go by the wayside. But as I say in my books, we have to plan for improving and maintaining our marriage by having dates, having time together where we do more than just, you know, plan who's going to pick up the kids this week after school.
Lamar, you know, one of the things that I have noticed is as we go through tough economic times, as we already know that it's difficult to raise kids while you're working on a marriage, one thing that seems to have eroded is societal support for marriages and for parents. Would you agree? I mean, is that something that you're hearing about on your blog?
Oh, definitely. That's even one of the reasons we even started the blog in the first place. You know, me and my wife always used to talk about how, you know, someone would come into a room and perhaps say, hey, I'm getting married, and what used to be a joyous occasion where everyone would, you know, surround that person with love and celebration, a lot of times is now turned into, you know, are you sure about that? You know, are you positive you're making the right decision? You know, you might even hear some people say, don't do it. So, I mean, that's something we definitely, I mean, that's one, like I said, one of the reasons we started the blog. And if I can just piggyback on something, you know, you were talking about a second ago, I think really, you know, keeping a focus on that marriage is something that you definitely have to do.
Well, Lamar, you got four kids, right? I got five. What's your line? What's your date line to your wife? Let's take Susan's advice here. How do you get your wife to go out on a date with you?
Well, it actually is not hard. She's willing to break out at any moment. She's always
let's
looking
go.
For a
that's
way
your
out.
Date line, right, Lamar?
Exactly.
Susan,
That's it. You know, I mean, and the thing is important too is we have a support system. You know, where a lot of times my mother, she'll say, you know, I'll watch the kids, or if not, we'll get a babysitter. Some of our readers even say they'll put the kids to bed early and just have like a picnic in the living room if they don't have the money to go out, because you have to work on that relationship. Because I guess we hear from time to time where you know, when the kids go away, couples and then break up because they don't know each other anymore, and we just don't want it to end up like that.
Well, I guess that's your takeaway. Get to know your spouse even when it's tough. Lamar Tyler's the married father of four kids, co-author of the website blackandmarriedwithkids.com, and Susan Nolan Hoeksema is a psychology professor at Yale University and the married mother of a 16-year-old boy. If you have a story about how you're feeling crunched on both ends, both the economy and your family, you can tell us at 8778-MYTAKE or email to mytakeatthetakeaway.org.
We've been getting stories about this idea, life in fine print. All week long, we're going to discuss how vigilant we all have to be to pay attention to and understand the various fees and taxes and issues that are all in the fine print. It relates to energy as well as our financial life. What have you learned to pay more attention to? Where are the fees hidden in your life? Amy writes to us on Facebook. I actually overheard a woman at the Michigan Secretary of State office who was registering her car ask the clerk if there was a tax on her fee. She said she was surprised and happy there was not. Don't people understand, though, that these fees are taxes? We've been so trained to expect hidden fees and taxes, we're all surprised when they're actually not
there.
That's
a depressing thought.
Well, that's why we want you to get more vigilant. Life in the Fine Print, it's our series all this week. Tell us your story, where you expect to find a fee and where you don't. And how have you been fleeced by the fine print?
Does that mean I have to read the back of my credit card bill?
Yes. Yes, it does. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
The vigilant Celeste, newly vigilant Celeste Headlee. And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
And not happy about it.
Do you know Houston like we know Houston?
Houston is filled with promise.
The yellow rose of Texas.
Heard about Houston?
Once we get to Houston.
Heard about Houston?
The largest city in Texas is a bit of a blue lone star in this red state. Houston, now the fourth largest city in America, has put its fiscal woes ahead of the culture wars. The brand new mayor of Houston joins us to talk of mandates and whether City Hall can fight Washington.
H-O-U-S-T-O-N-T-E-X-A-S.
The mayor of Houston on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Monday, December 14th, and The Takeaway is whether America's city halls, like the City Hall in Houston, are on the front lines of both the recession and the cultural and demographic changes afoot in America. It's a really interesting story down there in Houston.
Absolutely. And if all politics are local, it kind of argues that maybe everything pretty much is local when it comes down to it. But let's get right to it. Here's the headlines for this morning. Citigroup has reached a deal to repay the government $20 billion in bailout money. Citi is the last of the large Wall Street banks to pay back what it owes. A meeting later this morning between President Obama and the CEOs of the nation's biggest banks is shaping up to be a tense encounter. Here's what the president had to say last night on 60 Minutes.
I did not run for office to be helping up a bunch of fat cat bankers on Wall Street.
Aside from an increase in lending, the president wants the bank's support for a consumer protection agency.
We've got to have financial regulatory reform, and I want that in place next year.
The White House is expected to push the bank CEOs to provide loans for small businesses as a way to create jobs. Larry Summers, the president's top economic advisor, told ABC News over the weekend that job growth should begin this spring.
We were talking about depression. We were talking about the financial system collapsing. Today, everybody agrees that the recession is over, and the question is what the pace of the expansion is going to be.
The House of Representatives, not possibly as optimistic sounding as Larry Summers, is expected to take up a jobs bill later this week. Climate talks in Copenhagen have been suspended this morning. Representatives from developing countries are reportedly blocking negotiations by refusing to participate in any working groups. They're demanding that rich countries raise their pledges for reducing greenhouse gases.
Also in Copenhagen, the United States will announce an international plan this morning to deploy clean technology in developing countries. The $350 million five-year effort includes everything from putting solar lanterns in poor households to promoting advanced energy-efficient appliances. And the first major sponsor has ended its relationship with Tiger Woods. The global consulting firm Accenture says he's no longer the right representative for the company. Swiss watchmaker Tag Heuer, though, says this morning it will continue its association with Tiger. Overseas, Iran intends to put three Americans on trial for espionage charges. U.S. officials say that they mistakenly crossed a poorly marked border while hiking in northern Iraq.
Dubai receives a $10 billion bailout this morning from oil-rich Abu Dhabi. It's the last-minute cash infusion aimed at preventing an outright debt default by Dubai's largest company, Dubai World. And ExxonMobil has agreed to buy natural gas producer XTO Energy for a whopping $41 billion in debt and stock. And how would you like to drive a car that gets 135 miles per gallon?
I'd like it.
A lot of people would. So what Toyota says about its new plug-in hybrid, it has a lithium-ion battery and will be available in the U.S. in 2011. No word on cost, but Toyota says it will be, quote, affordable. Wall Street futures are up. The Dow opens at 10,471. The S&P opens at 1,106. And the NASDAQ starts trading on Wall Street in about 30 minutes at 2190.
All this week, we are talking about your life in fine print. print. Since the financial collapse, it's become vital that you take a look at the back of your credit card bill, that you take a look at the fine print on your mortgage, even on your utility bills. And we're asking you for your stories. Have you taken a second look at the fine print on your mail? And how have you been fleeced possibly by the fine print? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We're going to talk later this hour about that with Elizabeth Warren, chairman of the Congressional Oversight Panel.
Coming up, Houston's mayor-elect, Anise Parker.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
So, good morning, everyone. How many people in America know that Houston, Texas is the fourth largest city in this country?
I did not know that.
Indeed. Well, this week, people are going to know that the new mayor of that fourth largest city is Anise Parker, a comptroller, mayor-elect of the city of Houston, Texas, who becomes mayor after winning a runoff election over the weekend. Mayor Parker, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
And congratulations.
Thank you. It's been a long campaign, and I'm glad that phase is over. I'm looking forward to the transition into the mayor's office.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about talking about Houston, first of all, is that it is a city that is very different from the red state demographic of Texas broadly. And your election itself is in some ways a pitting of the fiscal woes of the city of Houston against the sort of culture wars that we've heard about throughout America. You're the largest city now, Houston, to elect an openly gay mayor. Some people are calling you, Anise Parker, a national political celebrity. What symbol do you choose to project this morning?
I want to focus on the city of Houston. The city of Houston would surprise a lot of people. We are a diverse international city, and actually one of the most diverse cities in America, with a very large presence of folks from born in many other countries in the world. We are a surprising, urbane, sophisticated city, probably better known across the U.S. borders than across our state lines.
How much of your election represents the changes that are taking place in Houston? Your main opponent was an African-American. Certainly there was a lot of divisive rhetoric in the campaign itself. I can hear in your voice there that it was an exhausting, long campaign.
It was a long and an exhausting campaign. The advantage for me is that I have been elected six consecutive times in the city of Houston prior to this. Voters were familiar with me, and they appreciated my honesty with them always. In this election, with the economy overshadowing everything else, coming out of the city controller's office gave me an added advantage. So the familiarity in troubled times, people want a figure they can trust. And I knew the numbers.
All right, so let's talk about the economy there in Houston. You've got a shortfall financially. What do you need from Washington? The president is meeting with a bunch of bank executives today. Maybe he should be meeting with mayors instead. What's your message for the president?
Mayors represent cities, which are the heart of America. And while Houston is probably better off financially than any other big city in America, simply because our local oil and gas economy sustained us longer, we're hurting like every other city. And, there was a lot of stimulus dollars programmed for cities, but to a large extent, the check is still in the mail. And we need that money to come down so that we can pay for the projects we need to do and put that money back to work in the economy through the multiplier effect of salaries.
You have a lot of political consolidation to do in the early going. You have some political battles with the vested interests there in Houston. Are you going to be able to both consolidate your power and take on some maybe big ideas? Mass transit is an issue in the Houston area. There are drainage issues in the Houston area, education in the Houston area. Are you going to be able to do those things?
I am going to do my best to keep as many balls in the air as I can. First task is balancing the city budget. We have some current very small gap to cover, but as revenues continue to decline, that challenge will be harder. We also have a serious understaffing issue in our Houston Police Department. I am focused on trying to find the money to recruit more police officers. Drainage is a long-term issue that I'm particularly interested in, but it's going to take a while for me to get to that one.
All right. Well, it's really interesting to hear how you tick off your agenda there. We're talking with Anise Parker, Comptroller and Mayor-elect of the City of Houston, Texas.
I was wondering what you think about the strategy, Ms. Mayor-elect, nationwide for getting civil rights and especially marriage rights for gays through referendum. It's a strategy that doesn't seem to have worked so far, and I'm wondering if you think there's a better way to go about it.
Well, I would challenge your assertion that that was a strategy that was put forward by the GLBT community. That was really a strategy imposed by those who wanted to block those kind of efforts. It was a preemptive strike, and it had a lot to do with presidential politics and what was going on in the national level. My focus has always been on the city of Houston. I present myself honestly to the voters, and I have a history of leadership in the GLBT community in my city and my state. But as a candidate, it is all about the city of Houston, and that's my priority.
Going forward, Mayor, what is the chance that this time, you know, in 2012, when we have another national presidential election, that the state of Texas electorally is going to look more like the city of Houston? What's the trend?
Well, our city and our state are changing demographically very, very rapidly. The Hispanic population in Texas is growing, and it's the largest demographic in the Houston area, and will soon be the majority in the state of Texas if it's not already. This upcoming census is going to be very interesting and challenging in a lot of ways. I believe we'll have a competitive governor's race in the state of Texas next year again. First time we've had one in a long time.
That's right.
And that may bring some renewed interest to Texas during the presidential campaign in 2 years after that.
Well, you've been doing a lot of media shots this morning live. What's the first order of business when you actually make it to City Hall?
I have not been able to spend enough time in the city controller's office over the last 2 weeks, so I have to get in there and get to work. I'm still on the taxpayer's payroll as controller, and I have a lot of things to move off my desk over the next few weeks. And then I will be meeting with my transition team to make sure that there is a smooth transition into the mayor's office.
All right. Well, thanks so much for speaking with us. Anise Parker is controller and now the mayor-elect of the city of Houston, Texas, the fourth largest city in America. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you.
That's great. And now at 50 minutes past the hour, let's check in on the stories we're following.
Overseas in Iran, three American hikers have been told they will be put on trial for spying. The hikers have been in jail since July after crossing the border from Iraq into Iran. Relatives and U.S. officials say they wandered into Iran by accident. In Afghanistan, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen is holding meetings with Afghan officials. Arriving at the Kabul airport, Mullen told reporters he was concerned about the growing, quote, collusion between Afghan Taliban and Pakistan militants. Back in the U.S., rescue teams say they'll continue to search for two missing climbers on Mount Hood in Oregon. The climbers were reported missing on Friday, hours after they failed to return. The body of their partner was recovered over the weekend.
It's a sad story. Citigroup has reached a deal to pay back the Treasury $20 billion of bailout money. The announcement comes just as the president is about to meet with top financiers at the White House today. And finally, Tiana, the star of The Princess and the Frog, has plenty to sing about.
I know exactly where I'm going. I'm getting closer and closer every day, and I'm almost there.
Hey, so it's a triumph for princesses.
Right.
For African-American young women.
And amphibians.
And amphibians. and Cajun music. And the whole New Orleans culture. It's a great movie. The Disney fairy tale, The Princess and the Frog, about a woman who gets turned into a frog and learns to cook, actually. It's a cooking movie.
It
as
is
well.
A cooking movie.
Earned $25 million at the box office this weekend. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, Tiger, Tiger, burning bright. Well, used to be the case, but with endorsers dropping him, how can he get his brand back? We'll talk in a few minutes to probably the most brilliant brand, most knowledgeable brand person I know. Cindy Gallup is going to be with us. Where does Tiger go from here?
Home.
No. In fact, no.
Hey, you want that to go?
You might say our two news takeouts this hour both involve sports and are both bigger than simply sports. Cindy Gallup joins us, advertising consultant and friend of The Takeaway. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway sports contributor here as always.
Good morning. Good morning.
So, Cindy, let's talk about Tiger Woods for a moment. He announces that he's taking a hiatus from golf, which, of course, hurts the PGA, which has its own branding issues. And then Accenture, the consulting company, decided it does not want to continue its professional relationship with Tiger Woods, undoubtedly a lucrative deal. First of all, how damaged is Tiger as a brand, do you think?
Well, I have to tell you, John, that all depends, to be frank, on the brand that is interested in associating itself with the Tiger Woods brand. And if I were Accenture, I would not be dropping Tiger Woods at all. And the reason for that is Accenture, quite frankly, put a pretty spuriously linked campaign in place when they began working with Tiger a number of years ago, in the sense that they took somebody who is obviously very well known for fantastic sporting performance and drew analogies between his performance and their performance in the realm of business. The irony is that, obviously, whatever you think of what Tiger Woods has been doing, that fantastic sporting performance hasn't changed. And so this is actually a moment for Accenture's campaign association with Tiger to come into its own. This is absolutely how they could demonstrate that every single business, every single brand can hit very, very rough waters every once in a while. And B, this should absolutely be also how they demonstrate their fantastic abilities and skills as strategic business consultants in terms of how they help brands and businesses address those choppy waters.
So Accenture should basically say, hey, folks, it's about performance. That's what we're about. But I guess the ultimate irony here is that Accenture, the name, came from a brand shift that took place in the wake of the Enron scandal when Arthur Andersen was suddenly degraded as a name and they had to come up with a new name themselves.
That's right. So they absolutely know about brand reversals of fortune. And I believe that they would demonstrate their abilities best as terrific strategic business consultants if they were to apply those to how you might address Tiger Woods' brand reversal of fortune.
Is this, in some sense, Cindy Gallup, and of course, as an advertising consultant, you're experienced in this as a whole strategy, is this a critique of the whole celebrity endorsement focus of advertising and, where it can really go wrong?
I believe it is, but it all depends on what you consider going wrong, because to some extent, it's a bit ridiculous to go, we're going to associate ourselves with and leverage the hell out of a relationship with a celebrity, but the minute they put one foot out of line, and literally in Tiger's case quite a lot out of line, that's that. There should be much more fundamental, very good reasons why you create a celebrity partnership in the first place, as opposed to the very spurious and tenuous links that a lot of businesses and brands come up with. And if there are very fundamental reasons for why you believe that relationship is a productive one, then there should be an acknowledgement of the fact that celebrities are also humans, and there should be a preparedness to find a way to actually potentially genuinely help each other, whoever's going through the reverse of the fortune.
Indeed. And the takeaway there, Cindy Gallup, and thanks so much for joining us this morning, is that the relationship has to be real. It has to be meaningful. If it's not, it really sort of doesn't matter, because celebrities are human like everyone else.
That's right. And if it's not, it doesn't really exist in the real world. We're going to move now to more sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. And Ibrahim, there's other things going on besides Tiger Woods and other sports. We've got, it seems like every single week, not only do we learn that we still have the Indianapolis Colts and the New Orleans Saints undefeated, but we're also getting closer to narrowing down who's going to end up in the playoffs.
So we've made some history this weekend. The Colts and Saints are 13-0. They joined seven teams in NFL history to make it to 13-0. That's amazing. And also the Indianapolis Colts, also 22 consecutive wins, which is also an NFL record.
That's
in the
regular
season.
If you go back to last season, right, count all the regular season last year. Hmm.
So that's pretty amazing. And this is the first time in NFL history that two teams have gone 13-0 in the same season.
So that's an amazing thing, but I mean, everyone's assuming, of course, they're going to be in the playoffs, but we know more about who else might show up.
So now we're getting a better picture of what's happening in the NFL. We know that those two teams are the top two teams. The Minnesota Vikings are one of the also the premier teams. The San Diego Chargers are a premier team. And then you start to get in the area of sort of a murky area. The Philadelphia Eagles are tough. The Cincinnati Bengals are tough. And then you start to suss out who's fighting for a wild card spot. And that's where it gets a little more interesting. In the AFC, you have three teams, the Ravens, the Dolphins, and the Jets, that are still, oddly enough, in position to be in the playoffs. And in the NFC, the Packers and the Cowboys have the wild card spot locked up, it seems. But the Cowboys have been in a December free-for-all, much like the last couple of years. The Cowboys are the most hyped-up team in NFL history, and they haven't won a playoff game in the entire decade.
They can't play in December.
Exactly.
You know, on this whole Tiger Woods thing, though, why is the NFL immune from this single-character kind of issue? Golf depends on Tiger Woods. Basketball depends on Michael Jordan. The NFL, somehow its business model doesn't depend on Troy Aikman or Tom Brady.
I think part of that is because there's so many players in the NFL, and players could literally disappear in a game, in a moment. An injury could wipe out your season, your career in an instant. So if you put all this stock into one player, you're simply not going to do it. Now, Peyton Manning is as close as it gets to a sort of an omnipresent person in the NFL and in the advertising world.
But still, you know, if he suddenly, you know, shacked up with somebody, it's not going to affect the NFL.
It wouldn't affect the NFL, and especially if
but
they went undefeated.
But he has a clean-cut-ish image.
He does have a clean-cut image. But he is the golden boy, and the new golden boy is Drew Brees, and look for them, too, to be the golden boys going forward for the Super Bowl.
Okay, thanks. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is the Takeaway Sports contributor. Coming up, we're going to talk to Elizabeth Warren about TARP. Elizabeth is the head of TARP, and we're going to start our series of Life in the Fine Print with her, talking about reading the fine print and the need to do so more and more these days as opposed to before the financial turndown.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. Coming up, the president will meet with the chiefs of big banks today. What can he say to get them lending again? I'll tell you what he can't say. You still owe us money. We'll talk about that in just a few minutes. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes past the hour. The climate talks in Copenhagen have been suspended this morning. Representatives from developing countries are blocking negotiations by refusing to participate in any working groups. They're demanding that rich countries raise their pledges for reducing greenhouse gases. Also this morning, Citigroup reached an agreement to repay the government $20 billion in bailout money. A complicated stock deal allows Citi to become the last of the big Wall Street banks to pay back what it owes. But Christina Romer, the head of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisers, says just because the banks have paid their debt to the government, it doesn't mean they should go back to business as usual.
There's a lot of blame to go around, but absolutely, we know that some of the practices that happened on Wall Street did set us up for what was a very severe financial crisis, and we are all still paying the price for what went on Wall Street.
We're going to have more on that story in just a moment.
Well, they've rung the opening bells on Wall Street this morning, and as the futures trading predicted, there's a bit of a rally underway. The Dow is up about 30 points in the early going, the NASDAQ up about 13, the S&P up about 2 points, reacting to the Citigroup announcement that $20 billion in bailout money is going back to the Treasury. Second highest U.S. general in Afghanistan says it will take longer to send some troops to the ramped-up war in Afghanistan. Lieutenant General David Rodriguez says the logistical challenges likely mean that the escalation will take 9 to 11 months to actually phase in, which would extend the surge beyond next summer. Republicans say you shouldn't bet on a health care reform bill coming out of the Senate before Christmas. GOP leader Mitch McConnell says it's a stretch to think the Senate will ignore public opinion and, quote, jam this health care reform bill through before the holidays. And markets also reacting to this news. ExxonMobil announced it's going to buy XTO Energy in an all-stock deal worth $31 billion as the oil giant moved aggressively this morning to capitalize on the growing supply of natural gas at home. XTO is a natural gas producing company. And that's the headlines we're following this morning.
The people on Wall Street still don't get it. They don't get it. They're still puzzled. Why is it that people are mad at the banks? Well, let's see. You know, you guys are drawing down $10, $20 million bonuses after America went through the worst economic year that it's gone through in in decades.
That's President Obama yesterday venting his frustrations with Wall Street on 60 Minutes. Today, he'll be meeting with the heads of major banks at the White House. What can he say to them that he has not already said? And this comes just after news about Citigroup reaching a deal to pay back the government and get out of the TARP umbrella. We're joined now by a couple guys who can shed some light on all of this. Eric Dash is the New York Times banking reporter, and Peter Morici, our friend and economist and business professor at the University of Maryland. Good morning to you both.
Good morning. Good morning.
Eric, the president has already met with bank executives. He had a large meeting with them back in March. He's been asking them to get back into the lending business ever since. What else could he possibly say to them this morning?
Well, I think he wants to show the American people that he's really engaged on this issue. I think it's a political move. It's political stagecraft to say, look, guys, you know, the American people supported you in times of trouble. We need you to get the economy back on track by lending, and we need you to act responsibly at pay. But as for hard outcomes, I don't think he's going to get specific commitments from the industry.
Peter, I want you to take a listen to this statement that Barack Obama had on 60 Minutes.
I did not run for office to be helping up a bunch of fat cat bankers on Wall Street.
So, Peter, maybe it's just tough talk that is going to change the tone between the president and bankers today.
I don't think there's going to be any change in tone. The president is rewarding the bankers. They're going to go dole out about $140 billion in bonuses. How much is that? The U.S. economy finally grew in the third quarter to the tune of $22 billion. So they're going to get six times the growth that was accomplished. Christina Romer in another clip said we're all still suffering from the recession. Heck, they're buying $200,000 Rolex watches on Wall Street. In Britain, they're clawing back the bonuses with a 50% one-time only tax on bonuses this year. You don't hear Barack Obama advocating anything like that. No. These guys contributed generously to Democratic congressional campaigns. They contributed generously to President Obama's presidential campaign. These bankers know how to invest their money well, and this is a cynical president that knows how to pay his supporters. Just like he bashed the health insurance companies and then rewards them with 30 million new customers, he's going to bash the banks. This is hypocrisy. It's obfuscation. Frankly, it sounds a little bit like Huey Long demagoguery.
Eric Dash from the New York Times, is the banking lobby still as powerful now as it was before this recession began?
Perhaps even more so, because I think that, you know, the stock market rebound and the economic recovery itself has reinvigorated it, and it's now sort of beaten back legislation in derivatives, in consumer protection, and in other areas. And so the president wants to make sure that his financial reform agenda goes through, and it's in trouble.
Well, Eric Dash, New York Times banking reporter, I don't want to do your job for you, but you might have a quote there from Peter Morici talking about Barack Obama's relationship to the banks. I'm wondering if there's a failure of logic here, though. Barack Obama wants the financial sector healthy. The banks are simply saying, hey, if we're paying high salaries, that means we're healthy. What's wrong with this picture?
Well, I think two things. First, the banks really aren't healthy yet. I think that they are no longer in crisis mode, but they're not yet healthy. I think that Wall Street and trading, that's healthy, and that's healthy because of taxpayer assistance. But the economy is still in a recession, unemployment is still at record levels, and the banks won't be healthy until unemployment goes down, and they're not going to lend into a recession. And so we have this paradox where, you know, the exact behaviors that caused the crisis may be necessary for us to get out of the crisis, but we can't go too far over the edge of the cliff.
Peter, it's been said often this is a jobless recovery, and yet we see that the banks are not loaning money to businesses who might be able to hire more people. In fact, loaning from banks fell by almost $600 billion from September to September during the past year. So what can get the banks moving? Can we force them to start lending?
Well, I think you need to change the culture on Wall Street, and you start by removing some CEOs. You know, we still own sizable portions, for example, of Citigroup. I don't know why we're letting them pay back the TARP money, as was agreed to early this morning when they caused this calamity. And the original notion was to dismember Citigroup to basically cover its losses. My feeling is it begins by denying these bonuses, just absolutely denying these bonuses. They earned this money, so to speak, by the Federal Reserve lending them at near zero interest rates and then trading them. Until you bring Jamie Dimon to heel, until you bring Blankenfein to heel, until you bring Vikram Pandit to heel, it won't change. You can't control these guys through regulation. They're too large. But, you know, they've contributed nothing but chaos to the economy. They tell us they should be rewarded for the marvels of their financial engineering. Oh, you mean like collateralized debt obligations and swaps that nearly brought us to the Great Depression again? No, there are fundamental changes needed on Wall Street, and that begins with changing the personalities. Unfortunately, Barack Obama has passed up his opportunity to do that, and I'm not surprised. His principal economic advisor, Larry Summers, took $5 million between being president of Harvard and the president's principal economic advisor. Heck, he gave a speech that lasted an hour at Goldman Sachs and got paid $175,000 a year. If I walk down Pennsylvania Avenue, it smells. It smells like Latin American corruption in the 1970s.
Wow, Peter Morici, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, always provocative. And we are also joined by Eric Dash, the banking reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And you have to wonder if perhaps the carrot or stick that President Obama still holds is the promise of tough financial regulations coming out of Congress. Coming up, we're going to start off our series, Life in the Fine Print. With things getting tougher economically, it's important to pay attention to the fine print in everything that you do in life. We want to know how you've been fleeced, perhaps by the fine print on a credit card bill or on your mortgage or on your utility bill. Let us know, 8778-MY-TAKE. And we're going to begin this conversation with the head of the group overseeing the TARP, Elizabeth Warren, coming up later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Here's a question. Is there a leftist political center of mass in Latin America? Let's go to Havana now, where leftist leaders of several Latin American nations, including Cuba, Venezuela, Bolivia, and Ecuador, have gathered over the weekend for a two-day so-called summit of the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of America. It's called the ALBA Alliance. And we were joined earlier this morning by Michael Voss, Cuba correspondent for our partner, the BBC. And I asked Michael whether this summit was shaping up to be a significant political movement on the left, or if it was more a celebration of the fringe in Latin America.
It's a mix of both, John. It's a highly politicized trade group backed by oil-rich Venezuelan money. It was set up 5 years ago with Cuba's then leader Fidel Castro and Chavez from Venezuela as a sort of radical alternative to U.S. free trade policies in Latin America. And from those two, it's then grown. There is a hard left core, if you like, at the moment. Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Evo Morales in Bolivia, who was just re-elected with a sizable majority. The rest are sort of, there's another half dozen nations here, including a couple of English-speaking Caribbean islands. Though none of those sent their presidents.
Uh-huh.
So there is a trade behind it, but they've come in, they have met. It was very interesting. There was a closing photo call at the end of the first day of the summit, and they all raised their hands in clenched fist salutes, the sort of, you know, the communist clenched fist salute, which I haven't seen any world leader do for many a long year.
Well, the Bolivarian Alliance doesn't refer to Bolivia as much as it refers to Simón Bolívar, of course, the revolutionary figure from Latin American history. To even evoke that term suggests that ALBA wants to incite or gain political credibility among the masses in Latin America. Any evidence they can do that? And barring that, do they have any sort of economic leverage that they can actually, compel concessions on the part of more centrist and right-wing leaders in Latin America?
I think the two sides. The Bolivarian, as you say, refers to Simón Bolívar, who was one of the great liberators of Latin America against the Spanish, a Venezuelan, but he helped liberate half a dozen countries in South America, going all the way down to Bolivia, which was named after him. And in many ways, Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez, has this sort of vision of himself being a sort of a pan-Latin American leader, becoming the new focus against this evil empire in the north. The United States is one. And remember, Venezuela's about the fifth largest exporter of oil in the world. So, you know, they have a lot of money. This is about Venezuela using its oil money partly to help poor countries in the region. A lot of this is about providing low-cost oil at cheap interest rates paid back over a long time. Cuba is sending medical teams to around the region to the poorest countries. It's sort of in some ways a self-help group of the poorer nations,
Interesting.
backed by backed by Venezuelan oil money. And other countries, you know, peasants in other countries are looking in, and it does have a resonance.
This is Michael Voss, Cuba correspondent for our partner, the BBC. He joined us earlier from the so-called Summit of the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of America. It's taking place in Havana. Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headley. You know, it's relevant to almost everything we do, from the energy you consume to knowing the details of your health care coverage to exactly how much you're paying for those services at your bank. It all involves reading the fine print. Coming up, we start our series Life in the Fine Print by talking with Elizabeth Warren, who oversees the TARP. She has to comb through a lot of fine print to oversee the TARP program in Washington. That's in just a few minutes. But right now, let's check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. In Afghanistan, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen is holding meetings with Afghan officials. Talking to reporters at Kabul Airport, Mullen told reporters that he was concerned about the, quote, growing level of collusion between Taliban and Pakistan militants. Talks at the Global Climate Conference in Copenhagen have stalled. Developing nations have blocked negotiations and are now demanding that richer countries pledge more money to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Representatives from developing countries have refused to take part in today's working groups.
Italy's Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is recovering in the hospital after being attacked at a rally in Milan yesterday. The Prime Minister has a broken nose and two broken teeth. Our partner, the BBC, spoke to one man who saw the attack.
It was a souvenir of the Milan Cathedral, probably made of marble or iron, but anyhow of some heavy material that hit him.
Doctors expect Prime Minister Berlusconi to stay in the hospital for at least one more day. A man with a history of mental health problems has been charged with aggravated assault. Citigroup says it's repaying $20 billion of the $45 billion it received in government bailout money. The remainder was converted into an ownership stake the government plans to sell. And President Obama will be talking to bankers and top financial industry executives at the White House this morning. Last night on CBS's 60 Minutes, the president complained about Wall Street financiers, saying that they feel like they're making good decisions and anything that goes wrong is someone else's fault. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
Fine print is everywhere.
There are fees for ATM cash withdrawals that go above and beyond regular ATM fees.
It was very hard to read.
The list goes on and on.
Try to make a sucker out of the customer.
No more fine print.
Post their overdrafts.
I mean, if you're a decent customer, it's just completely absurd.
I've been wasting all my time with
You know, in thinking about a lot of stories you report here almost daily on The Takeaway, it occurred to us that really a characteristic of the 21st century is becoming more vigilant, all of us, civically and economically, about the fine print in our lives. What are we spending? What are we really using? How are we really holding our institutions accountable?
What are we voting on?
Indeed, it's all in the fine print. And we begin our series, Life in the Fine Print, with Elizabeth Warren, who's the chairman of the Congressional Oversight Panel. It's the group that oversees the TARP, or Troubled Asset Relief Program. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
You know, part of your mission as overseeing the TARP program is really all about making sure that the fine print in this complicated relationship between the federal government and the banks is actually, is actually overseen, that there's a way of actually overseeing it. You've had to look at a lot of fine print over the last year.
That's right. It's about making it visible, because if it's not visible, we can't know what's really happening.
And do you think this is a good sort of idea here, the notion that all of us are going to have to really look at the fine print in our own lives, whether it's, as Celeste says, to figure out what we're voting for or to figure out what we're paying our own bank in fees, et cetera, that this is all a kind of redefinition of what it means to be a consumer in America?
Well, you know, I actually think it's really outrageous that this is what's required. Let's take the example of your credit card. A credit card agreement, all the papers they sent you in order to have a credit card back in 1980 was about 700 words. That's a little over a page.
Wow.
Today, most people say they've done the counting, the experts who've analyzed it, and they say a credit card agreement runs more than 30 pages. Now, they didn't add the additional 29 pages to make your life better. They added the 29 pages. I want to be clear here. Part of it, because some of it was statutorily required, you know, disclose this or tell people that. But most of it is in there in order to be able to hide a lot of tricks and traps. The idea of the fine print is not to help the customer. The idea of the fine print is to be able to hide things that will fool people. And, in fact, let me give you a great example of this.
Sure.
I wanted to check on my own credit card how much my interest rate was. My credit card agreement, when it says interest, right, had a little bold thing that said interest, little tiny print, 47 lines lines. It included words like LIBOR and points above prime and, you know, goes through all this. And then the very last line says, notwithstanding the foregoing, the company reserves the right to charge any amount at any time for any reason.
For heaven's sakes. Wow. Elizabeth Warren, chairman of the Congressional Oversight Panel, which oversees the TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. The assumption in all this fine print, it seems, Elizabeth, is that the banks are betting, the institutions, the companies, energy companies, et cetera, even the government is betting that Americans are really too passive to pay much attention to the fine print and that the money will just float their way. Is that a good assumption or a bad assumption?
I think that's a good assumption. Indeed, I'm going to say it slightly differently, too, in the case with consumers. They also assume that means you can't make any comparisons. So if you can't see which credit card is actually cheaper or which credit card has fewer risks or fewer penalties associated with it, then you'll be just as likely to pick the one that's more expensive or the one that has more tricks or, more to the point, the one that has a multi-million-dollar advertising campaign and offers double frequent flyer miles.
And, you know, your career prior to being the chairwoman of the Congressional Oversight Panel was writing books and teaching students with the mission of empowering them to understand how these things work, to not be fooled. Do you think that's a doable task in this environment where, you know, you got 30 pages on a credit card agreement?
No, I actually think that it has gotten so out of hand in the case of consumer credit agreements that it simply is not doable. It's been a few years now that I gave a credit card agreement to one of my classes. Now, these were all third-year law students at Harvard. They'd all had contract law. They'd all had a course in commercial law. And I asked them to determine, we were just having a back-and-forth conversation. We made a photocopy of the same thing. I said, work together and tell me what the interest rate is on this credit card and how you get your 3% cash back. And working together, it took them more than 45 minutes, and they still came up with two answers and weren't sure which one was correct.
All right, so what is the—
American families can't do that.
Exactly. So what is the—I mean, you've had a year now looking at the TARP. You've had an entire career looking at these complicated agreements that we're all sort of hamstrung with. What is the legislative takeaway here? Yes, we have to become more vigilant as Americans, but legislatively, things have to become more simple.
I think that's exactly right. So, for example, on consumer credit, the bill that just got out of the House is for a consumer agency that, and this is the first time we would have an agency like this, that says credit agreements, instead of having all these rules, you can't do this, you must charge that, you can't charge this, instead, what the real thrust of this agency is about is to say you've got to be able to say it in two pages. People have to be able to read it in 4 minutes with 95% understanding of what's going on. You know, the American Enterprise Institute has written a two-page mortgage. They've written a two-page check overdraft agreement. There's been another outfit that's written a one-page credit card. It's possible, if you want your customer to know what you're getting, to do that. And this agency is there to say, look, we've got to go back to a market where people can read it. Then they can make comparisons and they can make smart decisions for themselves.
You know, one of the things that you have talked about is the fragility of the middle class. Does these fine print things in our salaries, in our mortgages, and in our credit cards hurt the middle class?
You bet. It's like a hole in the bottom of your boat. They just keep losing not just a little bit of money. They keep losing cumulatively more than tens of billions of dollars every single year on the fine print. It's just, you know, it's it's floating out the bottom there.
And if you're getting $120,
no one ever sees it.
If you're getting a $120 million bank bonus, you can afford to lose a couple million, but the middle class doesn't have that luxury. Elizabeth Warren, before we go, you want to be the head of the Consumer Protection Agency?
I just want to see that agency get into law. That's what I really care about.
And you want to be the head of it, right?
Nah, I want to see it become the law. That's what I really care about.
Trying to make news here on The Takeaway. Elizabeth Warren, chairman of the Congressional Oversight Panel, the group that oversees the TARP, beginning our fine print series here on The Takeaway. Thanks so much.
And we're asking you to let us know how you've taken notice of the fine print, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeofthetakeaway.org. I'm Celeste Headley.
Got your own take? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You know how to reach us. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.